Thank you for listening to the podcast. Thank you for watching the podcast on YouTube. Thank you for just being a friend. Around the world and back again. Your heart is true. I don't want this video to get demonetized. Things are a little crooked. Let me fix them up. Hi, my name is Ron Funches. You can support this podcast by going to patreon.com/gettingbetterwithron and leaving me some shekels. You can support me by watching a show I'm in called Loot on Apple TV Plus, or Harley Quinn on HBO Max, or the upcoming movie 80 for Brady out February 3rd in theaters. It's a real theatery movie. Go see it with your dad or your mom. It'll be fun. Rock, paper, scissors coming to Nickelodeon sometime next year. These are the ways you can support me. Oh, watch The Great North. I'm on that a bunch. That show's fun. Other than that, twitch.tv, Ron_Funches. Watch Spirited because that movie's really good and I'm just promoting that for me because I like it. Other than that, let's get to the podcast. I hope you're feeling strong. I hope you're feeling brave. I hope you're having a happy holidays, a Merry Christmas, a happy Hanukkah, a Kwanzaa, a Festivus for the rest of us. Whatever you celebrate, I'm happy for you. I'm happy that you've made it through this year with so many people having. I'm happy that we've have our health, have our happiness, have our passions, things that we want to do and things that we love and enjoy. And to just be in the game, just being part of the game is good for me. I'm not happy to be here. I'm not one of those people. I'm definitely trying to crush and murder this next year. That's my goal, is to really step into my power as a man. You can see it in my chest and in my shoulders right now. You could really feel the 40-year-old power about to come off of me, the grown man dick. That I possess, both strong and sensitive, passionate and powerful. I'm on one, but I'm just feeling real grateful. Been a lot of weird things going on in comedy and last thing. A couple people were accused for being perverts and sexual creeps, and I just won't say knock it off. If you're doing that, don't do that. That's not good for our community. That's not good for us. There's plenty of women out there that hopefully would enjoy you just for you being you. So don't make anybody feel like they have to be forced into something. Usually just don't date anybody or try to sleep with anybody who is in you who is an immediate co-worker. You know, I understand people have relationships and stuff in this industry. It makes sense. Comedians understand other comedians, actors understand other actors. But maybe if somebody is your opener or something like that, don't hit on them. That seems like a good idea. Or unless you've known them for a long time. I don't know relationships. I know a lot of opener headliner couples that I just thought about. And I was like, baby, that doesn't make sense. I guess the whole thing is, I don't know. I guess some people, I mean, I get power and control issues, especially when you're a nerd or a dork or like I was 360 pounds and then you lose weight and you are suddenly, or you get attention because you're on television or whatever. And suddenly you're like, oh, well, maybe I don't have to act as nice to get people or whatever. Or I can just do whatever. Or maybe you're scared because you think people won't like you for you no matter what, and they always just wanna take advantage of you because you've been on television or they think you have money or whatever. But even still, just good people out there. There's good people in the world and there's people out there for you. And for me, I just get off in enthusiasm personally. I'm not into trying to force anybody to do something they don't want to be around and want to be involved in. So Just stop it, because it makes us all look bad, and then it's bad for comedy, and it gives people who are also looking for a reason to you know, talk shit about comedy, gives them a reason to be right. And so let's just, you know, I'm just putting a message out there for all people, all the fellas and the comedians out there. Get your shit together, pull it together, pull your shit in a big old sack, get it together, you know, because we gotta do better out here, because comedy is important and we don't want it to go away. And I'm not a fucking cop of comedy. I don't care what anybody does on stage. I really don't even give a fuck about what you do in your personal life, as long as you're not hurting anybody. But I do care about, like, leaving something behind, something better for people. And again, it just feels like that it gets lost on people. And maybe I'm just a different breed. I come from being a student of the game, from being a lover of comedy, an enjoyer of comedy. And so I want to water that garden. I want to nurture that garden. I don't want to just take and destroy and leave nothing behind for people behind me. We talked about this a few times. But either way, I'm grateful to just be in there. And that's what I've been talking about lately, is it's fun to have passion, have dedication, but make sure you're not, like, fully focused on just one thing. You need a full balanced life, just like you need a full balanced breakfast. You can't just have Chips Ahoy and milk, even though that sounds great right now. You gotta do good for yourself so you can have a full life, full spectrum. You can't just be focused on making money or comedy or whatever it is. It turns you into a weirdo. You gotta be a full participant in this actual world. You see so many people who don't care about anything but comedy, but climbing the ladder. And this is both men and women. You know, there's a lot of desperation in the world right now, but definitely in comedy and entertainment. There's less and less jobs. There are less jobs this year than there were a couple years ago. That's for damn sure. And so people get more and more desperate. And I get that 100% too. But you got to remember that you're here because you got something to offer, because you got unique skill set, because you're a good person, hopefully, and you can embrace those things. Don't let Los Angeles or New York or your environment change who you are as a person, or any relationships change who you are as a person. That's what I've been going through recently, is trying to reconnect myself to who I think I am deep down. Just reconnecting my spiritual process to the things that I enjoy, my tarot cards, my meditations, my breath work, whatever I'm into at the time. I'm trying to rededicate myself to that, because I've got a little bit away from it. It seemed like the more success I got, the more I was getting in, just be like, oh, okay, maybe I don't need that as much, but I would like being me. I don't care if I'm a weirdo to you people. I don't care if you don't get me. I don't care if I ever have a million Instagram followers or Twitter followers. That's not, I care about making money, being free, having fun. And that's what I'm about. And that's what my life has been for me. I got a beautiful message today I didn't plan to talk about, but since I got it, it's just something I won't bring up right now, just that I'm grateful for. That, you know, sometimes you need things, you get so caught up in the day-to-day that you need things to remind you of why you enjoy this and why you're having fun, you know. And for me, I got a message from a guy who I used to work with like 15, 16 years ago. And he was like, hey, man, it's been over a decade. I'm on a conference call at the call center. I used to work at a bank call center in Salem, Oregon. And there's a new hire named Ethan. What's up, Ethan? And the trainer was talking about how funny he is. And a few of the managers were like, uh-oh, we might have another Ron Funches coming through our doors. And what was so fun was the joy I heard in those managers' voices, remembering working with you. Big fan of your work. Your name still comes up at Wachovia, which is now Wells Fargo. And that just, boom, you know, sent me back mentally 100% back to when I had just started this endeavor, when I was going to open mics where literally two people would show up, when I when my son Malcolm, who's now 19, about to be 20, he was 2 years old. We're still wearing Pampers, still had negative bank account all the time. If I had a bank account, if I wasn't at the check cashing store. And so to see how far I am now, see the fucking arcade machines behind me, the life that I built, and see how far I still have to go. I'm only 39 years old and I look better than ever. Look how fucking cute I am right now with my Bowser hat. It just makes me optimistic, makes me excited for the future, makes me excited for life. And I just, you know, want to remind you, wherever you are in your life, it can change so much. If you're not where you want to be, it's great. If you're in a place where you are better than you used to be and you forgot how bad it used to be, take your mind back there. Sometimes I take myself back there to living in Roy Vaughn, Salem, Oregon, where I had I want to say sex worker or escort, because I'm very pro sex and into that type of, if you do that for work, that's beautiful. Thank you for supporting and helping people. But this lady was a prostitute. A 50-year-old old prostitute living above me, meth head living to the right of me. I'm just trying to go to open mics and get my son and my fan at the time wanted to get my wife too out of there. And to see where I am now, it's just night and day difference. And I'm always going to be grateful for that. Well, however my life goes, just give me opportunities. I know how to get it. I've taught myself how to get it, and I continue to get it. And I'm excited for 2023. I'm going over, you know, got the vision board party coming up. I'm going to go over some of my goals. I'm going to crush it in loot. I'm going to do so good in loot this year. Me and Joe Kim Booster are going to knock some scenes out of the fucking park. It's going to be beautiful. I'm excited about that. I'm gonna knock it the fuck out. We can go to some award shows. That's one of my goals. I want to just do great by my family, to make sure that my sons have a beautiful life, that they got trust funds, that they got everything taken care of for them, and that they still get a work ethic and taught to be kind and taught to be nice and taught to be humble, but also taught not to be humble and to shine in the face of these white motherfuckers. I'm sorry to make it racial, but that's my family. And that's how it goes sometimes. They try to take black people and make them own, you know, it's about the, if you know the song, what the humble song by Kendrick Lamar is really about. You know, even humble, be humble, sit down, be humble, sit down. Yeah, they know motherfuckers stand up and shine, bitch. Just like you can. I want you guys to enjoy this new year. Enjoy your life. Enjoy what you got, because you only get one. If you listen to this podcast, you're probably at least somewhat positive, somewhat optimistic. This ain't a podcast for some no motherfucking negative Nancy's. We all positive peppermint patties over here. And I'm so happy to have you, my small but mighty group. Let's make a fucking comedy special this year that's good. My first comedy special, I look you right in the eyes. I'm looking the camera right in the motherfucking eyes. My first comedy special is a goddamn classic. And I won't do it again. I won't make it better. I've been through some shit. I got some things going on, and I'm excited to talk about it and break it down and go deeper into it. And I'm gonna make a comedy special next year, and it's gonna be good. People gonna love it, and I want big names to see it, not just some little rinky dink thing. But I'm not gonna put an ego into it. Whatever happens, happens, baby. Comedy special, killing it in loot. I want you to see me in some motherfucking movies. I'm gonna be a good motherfucking dad. That's my plan for the year. I hope you got some great goals, and I just want to shine and enjoy myself and be confident in who I am. Look at the salt and pepper. I'm looking good. And you are too. You're beautiful. You're so beautiful and sexy. You out there living your life, killing it. And if you're not killing it, guess what? You could do better tomorrow. Get out there, take another crack at it. And enjoy this episode with my new friend, great comedian, got a great special out called Ooh La La. So please check out this episode with my buddy, Phil Hanley.
Hello.
Hello, Phil.
Hey, Ron. I'm good. Whoa, the room you're recording in looks so much more fun than the room I'm recording in.
It does. It seems like you're in a bunker compared to me.
I know, totally.
Where are you? Is this the office that you work?
I'm in my kitchen where I write jokes. And I normally have something covering the whiteboard, but as I clicked on with you, I realized I didn't put it up.
That's okay. People like to see whiteboards. It gives them information. It's like behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Are you a big whiteboard joke writer? Do you like putting...
Yeah, I got to. I pace in my apartment and... Yeah, when I started trying it, it was like a game changer. So I can like move around and write big and...
Yeah, I like using the whiteboard too. And I'm a big into index cards in a fishbowl sometimes where I'll put little premises in there and then I'll fish my hand around and sometimes I'll try them out.
Oh, that's great. I like that.
It's fun. Well, thanks for coming to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
Usually I start the podcast by telling people why I want them on the podcast and what I like about them. Phil, I like that you're very open and a storytelling type of comedian and my favorite type of comedian, which is someone where you watch their set and by the end of it, you feel like you learned a lot more about them. And in turn, sometimes you learn more about yourself. That's not everybody's cup of tea. I get that. Some people prefer other things, like when you're tearing down society or shining a light at the evils of the world. But I like somebody who just goes, hey, I'm dyslexic and I've been through this and I was a model and I did this and I really enjoy a chance to really like new comedy. And I was watching your special today, Ooh La La, or I'm going to call LA for fun. Just why not? That anybody could watch on YouTube right now, which I think would be fun to talk about the state of comedy with you and releasing specials. But it made me laugh so wholeheartedly and was so enjoyable. And so I just wanted to talk to you and get to know you a little bit better. But that's it. So thank you for taking the time.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for watching this special. And I admire that about you too and your comedy. I can't, that whole thing where I can't write jokes about other things. I don't know if it's like, I can only kind of write about myself or kind of my experience. You know, I admire people that look at, like social issues and stuff and are like, you know, breaking it down. But I don't kind of formulate jokes that way, you know?
Do you think it's vanity? Sometimes deep down I do.
I think it's vanity. There could be some vanity in it. I think as a kid and being dyslexic, I felt very unheard, like people are really quick to just be like, oh, we can't read. And I still feel that now. People don't fully understand. So now all of it, I couldn't contribute in class. I couldn't contribute if friends were talking about like a book they read or whatever. So I feel like now all of a sudden I have the microphone and I'm like, okay, this is why I feel like I'm, you know, like justifying certain things or whatever I have. It's like empowering for me to talk about being dyslexic.
No, I get that completely because I feel whenever I talk to people who don't work in comedy and stuff and they're always like, oh, wow, I couldn't imagine the classic. I couldn't do what you do. It seems so scary to get up there. And I'm like, oh, actually, it's usually the one place where I feel in control, where I
absolutely
have a microphone. You are forced to look at me. You're forced to listen to me. I actually am much more awkward at a dinner table if there's like more than four people and the conversations start splitting off because then I don't know who, if I'm bothering somebody, you know, I get a little bit awkward about that. But when I'm in, I feel like the stage in a life where I was younger, I didn't necessarily have a lot of control and it gave me a place where I'm like, this is about me. Is that something for you as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, totally that. And I mean, comedy is one of those things. It's like when you at first it's scary or, you know, it's like daunting or whatever. But once you kind of get into the habit of it, you know, writing and the trial and error, whatever, can be, you know, challenging coming up with, you know, material that really connects with people. But beyond that, it's easy once you do it long enough. And I marvel at people. Like, I'm like, I have friends that work in like steel mills and stuff. And I'm like, there's no way that I could keep it together to operate a crane in a steel. To me, that is way more impressive than, you know, going to a club and taking the microphone out and, you know, doing your act. That a real job is so much more impressive to me than, you know, or a teacher or, you know, for me.
So
for
steel
sure.
mills, you're like, at least I'm not at the steel. When you have a bad set, you're like, at least I'm not at the steel mill.
I think about it. Yeah. Like I think at least I'm not. And my friend's great at his job. And, you know, I think he, you know, it's not something that he dreads doing, but for me, yeah, like it's, when I have a bad set, or more like, you know, if I have a flight to Dallas at 7 a.m, you know, and I'm setting my alarm for like 5:30, especially travel, I always remind myself, like, I could do a job that I'm not passionate about or something that I, you know, don't enjoy doing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always important to remember that. I mean, it's a simple thing, but talking to someone recently where I was like, I have to go do this. And as soon as they caught me saying it, I was like, I know what they're going to do. They're going to be like, well, you get to go do this.
Yeah.
You get to do that. And I'm like, I know. Shut up.
Yeah. No, I know. Yeah. Sometimes, I mean, and sometimes you're like, you know, don't feel like doing a show, or maybe beforehand, I just did a weekend in Dallas, and it was like, there were a lot of Christmas parties. And I feel like sometimes with performing is a real exercise in not prejudging something. Cause I know from starting out, Christmas parties can be a problem because it's, you know, not everyone wanted to go. This Christmas party was 150 people. So out of those 150 people, some of them wanted the party to be at a bowling alley. Some of them, you know, whatever, haven't had good experiences with comedy or whatever, but I find, so you dread it before maybe, but it turned out it was great. It was fun. So it's a real, I think you can use that in other aspects of life where you're like, learn to not prejudge something as it's going to be a negative thing when so often, you know, it turns out to be fine.
Yeah, that's something. I had Maria Bamford on the podcast, and that was one of her pieces of advice that I still use to this day, is that to not prejudge a situation and not tell yourself that I know how this is going to turn out. Because we often do that where I would get ready to go. And often those are then like, you know, you make that happen yourself by like, if you come in with a bad attitude and you're like, this is going to suck, then it does suck.
Yeah. And with comedy, I feel like I've learned that lesson so many times when you'd be on a show and, you know, people will be struggling or there'll be people be whatever. You get in your head like, oh, this is going to be terrible. And then you're on stage and you're like, no, this is actually great. Like it just worked in your favor. The expectations were lowered or whatever happens, and you have a good set and you're like, it's such a bummer. I could have enjoyed that like half hour before I went up instead of like torturing myself with, you know, what didn't even occur.
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually one of my mantras now. Whenever I have something that I don't want to face, I always remind myself, I go, nothing has ever turned out to be as bad as you make it out to be in your head.
Like, that's a great mantra. It's so true, too.
It's always turned out to be for me because my head is powerful. I'm like, I'm going to tell them this and they're going to shoot me.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Gonna be so mad they're gonna attack me. You know, absolutely. I go that far in my head.
And also with stand-up, and I guess it applies with like, you know, just life in general. It's like so often my strengths on stage are because I went through tough shows, you know, especially when I started in Canada and, you know, we would tour, you'd like cross the Rockies and it would be rough situations. You know, there were loggers in the audience and there were, you know, I would follow like a UFC bout and then they would throw on a comic to try to keep people in the bar drinking and stuff like that, where these like bloodthirsty people are now listening to my jokes or whatever. But those, they make you mighty, you know, and they prepare you for other things.
Oh, absolutely. To this day, I remember my sets at like a Ponderosa truck stop just in front of all these truckers who didn't want to see me, just wanted to eat their dinner. But I'm like, I gotta do it. I get free nachos if I do my set.
Yeah.
You know, are the same thing. I remember doing a set for the UFC cage, doing a set in the UFC cage as well.
Whoa. What was that circumstance?
It was just in Tacoma. It was in like Tukwila, Washington, in the Northwest. There was just a lot. There was, especially during that time, a lot of amateur cage fighting going on. And so you just go in and you do stand up. I mean, I'm assuming what you do. They do fight. They do stand up. A girl would walk around. Nobody would listen to you. And if you were loud and yelly, you would survive. But if you were like me, you would be like, man, I really got to stop doing these type of games.
Wow. Yeah, there is, and I know this from like, yeah, there's bad gigs, and then there's like gigs where you're like, there's a tinge of violence in the air, and those are the real, like, where you're like, yeah, this is ugly. Like, I got to get off stage and into my car and go, you know?
Yeah, you're like, there's some where you're like, I didn't learn anything here. I got to learn to not feed this addiction this bad. Do a stand up. Oh, when did you get started in stand up? How long have you been doing it now?
I've been doing it for, I think I get really bad with dates, but like around 18 years now.
Okay. Yeah. Nice. And is this how many specials? Is this your first special or how many?
I did a special that I wish people would not watch, about 4 years in when I was still in Canada. I was way too soon to do a special. And then I did a Comedy Central special, like an hour. And then, yeah, I did it. I kind of did an album in between, but yeah, this is my first kind of like, you know, it's 45 minutes, but like my first kind of like hour special. Yeah.
First, you're like, I look at it like, you're like, here's this, like my full meal that I'm presenting to you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
How do you feel about it? I think it's great. I haven't fully completed it yet, but from most of it that I've watched, it seems really good and really enjoyable. How do you feel about it?
I was happy with it. It was more expensive than I anticipated it to be.
How much was it?
Well, it was supposed to be $20,000. I thought it'd be $20,000, and then it went. I don't know the final figure, but it did surpass $20,000 quite quickly. It feels really good to have it out. And obviously I would love to have sold it to Netflix or something like that, but there is something that feels really good about the way things go now, where you can, before people were releasing them on YouTube, you'd put together an hour and you'd hope someone would buy it. And if someone didn't buy it, well, I don't know what you would do. So now it feels good. Like I'm putting together a new hour, and I'm thinking like, yeah, like obviously love to go to Netflix or love to go to, you know, a platform where people are going to see it. But if not, it does feel really empowering just to record it yourself, pick everything yourself, and then just put it out and start again, you know?
I also would imagine as someone who is Canadian, then even things like Comedy Central, as much as you're like, oh, it's great to get the special and get some money and stuff and get a little boost. One thing that I was really annoyed by with my special was just the fact that, like, on the online thing, people were like, oh, just even as far as Canada, they couldn't watch it.
Yeah.
So with YouTube, it's so nice to, or even when they put it on their YouTube, they were still geo-blocked. So it's nice to have more control and have people to be able to discover it. But I also do worry about the, basically, I guess I would just call it like undercutting of the price of these specials, you know?
Yeah, that's true. So,
when people are willing to create them and put them out for free or put them out for things, then it doesn't necessarily spur the prices that the specials that we, you know, people used to get, or a lot of people, you know, when those big, big names are, you know, getting the eight figure deals, you know? So it makes me just a little bit concerned about that, but I don't know how to think about it. It's one hand, it's very free, very open. On the other hand, does it devalue? What do you think, Phil?
I think you're right. It's so great. I never thought of that. That's such a great point that you're making about devaluing it. But I feel like people are really, I mean, it's kind of like bands now where it's like, you know, people get music for free. Basically, the bands don't make as much money off like records and stuff, but then, you know, you make it on the road. So my hope was put it out. People will, you know, would see it and then hopefully make that money back, you know, selling tickets on the road. But, you're totally right. I mean, it does, devalue it in a sense. I'm really touched. A lot of people have been, and I didn't want to do it. I felt very weird. I don't know if it was like a Canadian thing or what, but the editor who did my special and helped me, you know, put it on the platform and stuff was like, you got to put your Venmo, you know, people send you money. And I was like, ugh, that feels really weird to me, but I did do it. That was
going to be my question, actually. If like, I mean, if you had considered even a Kickstarter or some type of thing of that nature.
I with Kickstarter and stuff like that, I was like, I was fortunate enough that I could afford to pay. When I think Kickstarter, I was like, I'd rather that go to like, someone who, you know, needs it for like to keep their house or, you know, to get some type of medical treatment or something. If that was, I don't know if there's a correlation there, but I'd rather people donate to something like that. I'm confident. I'm happy with how the special came out, and I'm confident that I can make the money, on the road, but you're totally right. It does in a sense devalue it, 'cause then people are used to seeing it free, you know?
Yeah. It does. I mean, 'cause I just can think about that. I'm really just talking about for myself, 'cause I'm getting a lot of material together and I'm getting to a point where I'm like, oh, I could get, if I really focus, I can get things together for another special in the near future. And I'm like, what would be the best route for me? Would I rather fully own it and put it out on something like YouTube, or do I want to shop it around? And is it going to, I mean, and also, I mean, a lot of people just think about the act of putting it out and putting out the material, but from myself and from other friends that I know, the act of actually selling the special can be very daunting and soul crushing in some ways, and make you second guess your value. And just having, you know, people say, well, I'm willing to give you this much, or I'm not even willing to talk to you at all, you know? And you know, you're good. You know, you're out on the road. You're seeing people do, you know, love it. Like even when my, you know, when my special came out, I wanted so bad. I was a big Netflix lover and I wanted my special to come out on Netflix, and they were like, we'll give you a half hour. And I was like, I you know, I'm not poo-pooing a half hour, but I've done a half hour, and I'm big into challenging myself and trying new things. And so it's not about really the money or the exposure to me. It's about, being a comedian who's done an hour special, because when I was a kid, there's a distinction between someone who's done an hour and who hasn't. And so that was important to me, and I put my all into it. And then it meant a lot to me later when I saw some of the effects from Netflix and they were like, that was a very good special. We wish that we'd had your special. And like, that made me feel good.
Yeah.
But you know, at the same time, I'm like, you guys hurt my fucking feelings.
Yeah, no, it does. Because, I mean, for people that put personal material out there, there is an aspect where it's like, you don't just like my jokes, you don't like kind of my life story, and you don't like, it's hard not to take it personally. And at the moment, like you were saying about other platforms, like, it's so weird that, you know, you sell a special on Netflix, it's lucrative, and it can be seen all over the world. And a lot of other platforms, that's just not the case. You know what I mean? So it's weird where it's like, either you get paid a lot of money and it's seen all over the world, or if you want it seen all over the world, you lose a lot of money. Like, you invest your own money and you put it on YouTube. Like, it's so weird that those are the two kind of ways. And hope, you know, that could change. Maybe there'll be a platform that's, you know, more international and stuff like that. But at the moment, the best way to get eyes is YouTube and Netflix, which are
I agree with that. I've often said that, and I don't know whether I'm wrong about the market or if I'm ahead of my time or if I'm just, you know, stupid. Who knows? But I'm a big pro wrestling fan, and there's been a lot of always, you know, the WWE Network but that people know about. But there's also the smaller thing called Fight TV, where they group together all the independent wrestling, and you kind of go in a la carte. You have their app, but you go in and you go like, oh, I like this company. I want to buy their show for $9, or I want to buy their show for $5. And I was like, comedy needs something like that, where you can, when you go, I know where the specials live, but I can go in and pick because I like this person. Or if there's a channel that's like, well, if you like this, then you might like this. I think there's a market for that. And I hope somebody steps into that place. That would be fun.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that you like wrestling. When I got to the States, I realized how many comedians are really into wrestling. And I was into wrestling when I was a kid, but now I'm into more than like the actual bouts. I love hearing stories about wrestling, like, you know, getting to gigs. And to me, it feels like so similar to comedy. There's such parallels there. And the struggle and, the people working their way up and the toll it takes. Obviously, it takes a physical toll on wrestlers, but it does, can take a toll on comedians, emotionally more. I get fascinated by those stories, like the Dark Side of Wrestling on Vice, that whole series. Yeah. Oh, my God. Like I just stumbled upon it, I think, during the pandemic, and I just binged. I couldn't get enough of it. It's fascinating to me.
Oh, yeah. No, there's a lot of parallels. I mean, to me, I'm always a big fan of that vaudeville style, that it's all kind of the same stuff of whether you're a musician, actor, juggler, tap dancer, wrestler, fire eater, whatever. We're all kind of doing the same work, and I met a lot of wrestlers and it basically is the same type of life. And it's really cool to watch people who you see kind of at the open mics of wrestling and then see them make it to television. And it's, all the same type of stuff. And it's really inspiring to me sometimes. Yeah. What's your passion outside of comedy?
I love the Grateful Dead. I'm into the Grateful Dead the way, say, my friends that are in the wrestling would know. Like, I know all the statistics. The Dead's great because it is almost, there's a sporting element to, like, when the last time they played that song, or, how they've changed during the era. So that is like my passion, as to like kind of like my lifeblood or my interest that is super far removed from comedy. That is nothing.
What have you learned from? Because I learned so many things from wrestling that I apply to comedy. What have you learned from the Grateful Dead that you apply to what you do?
The big thing that I've learned is that none of their shows were ever the same. Each version of the song were never the same, and they played, over 2000 shows, and they always mixed it up. And I really try to do that. I try to improvise, a lot, I do it through crowd work and stuff. And, I love the idea of like each show I leave and I'm like, so that was that for you guys, like that, the late show is going to be completely different. Some dude named Ron isn't going to be sitting in the front row. And the law student is going to be over to the side. I love the idea that each show is kind of its own thing, even though, jokes repeat themselves or whatever. But that's something that I've really got from them. And also from Bob Weir, who's one of the living still members, talks about like when he's playing music, time kind of dissipates. And I really try to embrace that in comedy. And that happens when I'm improvising, where it's like, if you like riff a lot, you don't know sometimes have I been on stage for 15 minutes? Has it been half an hour? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's the part.
Oh, I absolutely know what you mean. For sure. You learned that. I don't know if you've ever taken any acting lessons, but we've talked a lot about that in my acting class before. And I was able to relate it to stand up, where I'm like, I'm a straight weirdo anyway, but I'm a big believer that time is a man-made construct. And one of the things that let me know that is stand-up comedy, because when you're truly in the zone, you are kind of, you're stepping outside of the timeline, because you're in the present delivering a joke, you're in the past deciphering what your last joke was and how people related to it and adjusting on the fly for your joke, and then you're in the future contemplating what you're going to do next. And at the same time, sometimes you're up there going, man, I'm killing. Right? Yeah. So you're doing so many things that are impossible to do if time truly is real. That's
Wow, that's another thing I've never really thought about it. I have marveled at, like, say if you're just like sitting watching TV or just going about your normal life, how different just your brain is functioning than when you're in, when you're on stage. And I'm sure people must have this with athletics, and I'm definitely with wrestling and stuff, where you're in the moment, you're telling the joke, you're can hear someone chatting over the corner. You're trying to gauge if they're talking loud enough for you to address it. If the people over here can hear, like, you're using these skills that you didn't even know, like, you're using these weird skills that you didn't even know were going on.
One of my favorite skills that comedy has ever taught me is how is to decipher what type of laugh that I'm hearing. Like, you know, where you're like, okay, they're laughing because they're on board. Are they laughing because they're making fun of me? Are they laughing because they're having a completely different conversation?
Yes.
Like, I can hear the differences in all those laughters. And that not only works when I'm doing stand up, where I'm able to be like, oh, call it out if I hear somebody doing some side talking, but it also helps in my real life when I'm like, oh, I know that laugh. They're talking shit about me right now. And they don't know that I know they're talking shit about me right now.
Yeah, you do. You become, you do learn. Yeah, certain laughs, it's almost like notes in music or something. You do learn. Or there's like, I've even noticed just more and more, and it's just been fairly recently, where more people are coming out specifically to see me. And you can tell, you can even hear like the woos when you're walking to the stage. The host is always going to be like, give it up. But you can actually hear it more where there. That's a specific woo. That's a woo. They know me woo. Mm-hmm. And I also find what you're saying with heckling, which you can use off the stages, where when I started, if anyone interrupted, that was considered a heckle or whatever. But now someone can heckle like just because they're moved by the joke or they're invested or it hits home with them. They'll be like, and it's so key. The last thing you want to do is turn around and like start berating someone who is just like, I'm so connected to what you're saying. I had to go like, totally, or whatever, you know? And then there's an echo that is, it's normally a guy who's not comfortable with you being the center of attention for that 45 minutes or whatever, and is trying to be disruptive. There's like a mean-spirited heckle, and there's a like overboard onboard heckle or whatever. And it's so funny how you just learn that, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's helped me with my parenting in dealing with hecklers in that way. When I was young, when I was first starting out, my initial dealing with hecklers, no matter what, my default was just to go, shut the fuck up.
Absolutely.
And sometimes it would make people laugh because they were on board, but sometimes they didn't hear it as I heard it,
yeah,
because I'm close. Or sometimes that person was chiming in a good way, like you said, but because I wasn't seasoned enough to decipher any of those things, I just had a default and I just went with that. And now I deal with it like I would deal with my sons, where I go, let me just listen and decipher what you need. Do you need, are you just needing me to give you some affirmation, like you're chiming in and you just need me to go, yeah buddy, yeah, great, or just like, oh, you know, I'll need your help when I ask for it, just, you know, or do you need me to spank your ass right now? But I'm not going to assume you need a spanking.
Yes.
I'm going to listen and find out what you need.
Yeah.
And it's really helped. I had to spank a guy yesterday because he was just kept chit-chatting. And I did go to the shut the fuck up, but I hadn't done that in years.
Yeah.
You know? And it was just nice to be able. Yeah, it's just very helpful. I love talking about comedy. It's fun.
It is, because it's weird, because you become, it's not like you can know about stuff, but if you're a comic and if you do it for years and years and years and you do it most nights, you do become somewhat of an expert, and it carries over. There's like a psychology side to it. There's a understanding people, you know. Yeah.
You become a student of reading people.
Yes.
You know how to spot a troublemaker.
Yep.
You know how to spot somebody who you should engage with if you want to do some type of crowd work, as opposed to like
do not talk to that person because they're going to derail this show. Yeah. You start to you profile people.
Ron, you do it and you do. I had a, I was at one of my favorite clubs on the planet. I was at the Punchline in San Francisco. I walked out and I do a lot of crowd work and I post crowd work clips and I have some crowd work in my special and stuff. And I walked out and immediately looked on a guy's face and I could tell he was there because he was a fan. He followed me and he wanted to interact with me. His plan was to sit in the front and get me to talk to him. And he was wearing a very brightly colored Western shirt, you know, not like a you'd work on the ranch, but more like a rodeo type shirt. And I was completely right.
He was peacocking. He was out there peacocking.
He was 100% peacocking. And I ignored him the whole show. And then at the end, I acknowledged him like in the last 2 minutes. And I knew I had my closer in the bag so I could get out, you know, on a laugh and stuff. And I acknowledged him. As soon as I acknowledged him, he stood up with his hands above his head, spun around for the whole audience. And part of the reason I acknowledged him was because I just wanted to know if I was right. And I was right. And I don't know how I profiled them and picked them out correctly, but yeah, that was his goal. That was his goal. And it was scary for me because I was like, oh my God, is that going to start happening? Because that would destroy my act. Because I don't want to talk to someone that wants to, I want to have a legit conversation.
Yeah,
with someone.
Yeah. Nothing derails crowd work than the person who was trying to be funny with every response.
Absolutely, because you can't go anywhere with it. You know, especially if your jokes are based in human experience and reality, I don't need some wild, you know, I don't need like, did you have a pet when you were a kid and someone says they had a dinosaur? You're like, oh, great, dude. Like what? You know what I mean? How can you relate to that?
I work at the dildo factory.
Yeah. No, but yeah. Did you have a pet? I had a dildo factory. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Well, Phil. One of the main things that I like talking about on this podcast is goals. And one of my favorite things to talk about is when people who accomplish the goal, like shooting a special and putting things out, is what they're feeling at this moment. If they're feeling free, what you're focusing on. If you're trying to make another special or acting or whatever you're interested in, spiritual health, what are you working towards, Phil?
I sold a book. I'm writing a book about dyslexia. I'm writing a book about the positive aspect of dyslexia. And that I'm about halfway done. Anyone who knows anything about dyslexia knows it's a crazy endeavor. It's you know, it's hard. I work on it every day. But I'm really excited because doing the research, I started reading books about dyslexia and these experiences that I thought was just me, it was other people. And through selling the book and working on it, I've started working with an agency called Eye to Eye that goes and advocates for kids with learning challenges like dyslexia or ADHD or whatever. And it's so amazing to talk to these kids or talk to anyone of any age and hear, like, you know, we kind of go through the same thing. So that's what I'm currently working on. That's what I'll work on, you know, first thing tomorrow morning. And then I have shows. So I'll then, you know, I'm always kind of working on my act, you know, for an hour or whatever. But I'm trying to put all my energy into, you know, getting the book done and getting it out. And I can't wait to do a book tour after to playing clubs forever. I can't wait to just go. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. People are sitting down and probably not.
If they're drunk, it's a real issue.
Yeah. If you're bombed in a bookstore, it is a real issue. Yeah. So the book is really kind of my main focus.
Oh, nice. You know Moses Storm? You ever talk to him? He has dyslexia.
Yes, I do know Moses. I met him in New York.
Racist to say something like that? Like, no. You don't know this other dyslexic person?
No, but it's funny because I had met him and then I didn't hear that part of his act where he discusses dyslexia. And so we've bonded over that. We have connected. He's not because he's I guess he's shooting a show. He's in New York City now. I know he was in LA for years and years.
Yeah, I always thought that was interesting because he does so much acting, and I was like, oh, he's such an improviser, and I was like, oh, I didn't know it was a fight or flight reason. I thought you just like doing it.
Yeah, no, yeah, it's survival, I'm sure.
When did you shoot this special? How much new material do you have now?
Whew. Ron, I wish I had more. I shot it about, it was a year ago. It's out now, but it came out, you know, just a few weeks ago or a month ago or something. Mm-hmm. And I shot the special and then immediately started working on the book. So I only have probably like a new 20 minutes, but for me, I tell short jokes, so it does take longer time to add, but I'm postponing my trip to Canada to celebrate Christmas with my family so I can be here in New York and do a ton of spots and hopefully, you know, get a lot of reps in and get it. So I have a lot of new jokes.
Well, I wasn't trying to chastise you.
No, not at all. Not at all. But I feel like people just put out, I think, you know, people started putting out specials every year. That's more me chastising myself, which is something that I probably shouldn't do.
And again, I feel like those people are making a mistake and are part of the reason why these specials are getting undervalued. Start sitting on this material. That's what I'm doing.
Well, yeah,
just like sitting on it.
Because it only gets it really only gets better.
It really does. I've been able to disconnect things from other things, apply them to my life, deepen them in ways. And that was actually, and I'll ask you the question based off of me. When I did my first special, you know, I read some of the reviews and they were generally positive. And then some of this I look at again, like wrestling or like an athlete where I'm like, this is game tape. And I'll take some of the criticism that I agree with and I'll try to apply those messages, you know?
Yeah.
And some of the things, the main ones that I saw, you know, when I saw them more than once, the main thing were that people were like, oh, he talks some of these things, these references that are a little bit superficial. And we want to hear more about his son. We want to hear more about his life. And I was like, so my main note to myself when I started writing new jokes was just go deeper. Because I always find myself like I would touch a subject and I move on. And yeah. Now I'm trying to really mine and dig and lay into a subject a bit more and it takes me longer. And I think I'm lucky in the fact that I like doing so many other things so I can do the voice acting or do write on something and not necessarily be like, oh, I need to put out another hour so that people keep booking me. But so coming out of this last one, was there anything that you would tell yourself or you had been like, this is what I want to work towards or I want to focus or I want to lean in towards more for the next one?
Well, I mean, it's funny what you were saying about like doing voice acting and working on shows and stuff. That is the one misconception I had when I started comedy where I was like, no, I want to just focus on stand up and I want to be there to be present. And all those things complement stand up. Everyone you meet, not everyone you meet, you're going to get a bit about, but it's going to give you something. And the more people you meet, the more likely that you will be inspired for something. So, I mean, one thing that I've decided, because on my first album, my first CD, I talked about being dyslexic. My comedy special, I talked about being dyslexic and I felt weird about repeating a topic. And then I'm like, no, I'm just going to be, that's something that I deal with every single day. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to embrace, you know, I'm not going to censor myself if I'm like, that's the same topic as I did on another special or whatever. So,
yeah, I would agree with that. I think everyone I've ever seen do comedy does that. I think a lot of people tell the same 10 jokes a different way. And that's what your career is sometimes.
Yeah. No, it's so true. It really is true. But no, but I agree with you. Like, I'm not rushing. It does feel good to put a special out and it feels good, like, talking to you and doing different podcasts, an excuse to, like, promote and connect with people's stuff. But, I am going to kind of take my time and definitely, you know, especially if these specials now live forever. You know what I mean? So I agree with you. I don't think it's like a mad rush to put it out. And I guess you're right. I never even thought of that. Putting out a special every year could devalue the whole thing. I never thought of it like that.
I just think about business stuff a lot. And just complex web is very important. I think once you're talking about, if you're just doing stand up, and some people are great specialists, you know, I would never be like, everybody's got to be a jack of all trades. That's just what I'm good at. If I focus on one thing too much, I burn out. I'm very passionate, and I put my all into everything, and I take things personally. So, if something doesn't go well, if I didn't sell a special to the place I want to, I take it very personally. It hurts hard. If I don't sell a show, they turn me down for a thing. I take it personally. It's why I tried not to go willy-nilly into a situation. I try to really think about, like, am I really want to do this? Am I willing to take another loss for this? You know? And if the answer is yes, then I jump in with it. So for me, I just, like you said, it just gives me more to write about, more life to live. It's something I talked about with Emily Gordon years ago, and we just talked about cannibalization of your act. At some point, if your whole life is about stand-up, then your stand-up becomes about stand-up, and then you're so niche that it doesn't really have heart to connect with real people, you know?
Yeah, I was saying this weekend in the green room. I was saying, like, it's, you're kind of at your funniest when you're not, when you kind of just accept yourself and you can't be needy. You're at your funniest when you, obviously you care immensely, but then you also don't care. Like, it doesn't, each show doesn't feel so monumental. I mean, it's the same when you're approaching someone of the opposite sex. If you're like, oh my God, this person's so attractive, that conversation is not going to go well. And it's the same with stand-up. If you're like, oh God, these people need to love me. And the way you do that, I agree with you 100%, is having these other things. You know what I mean? Like anything, relationship with friends, relationship with families, you know, hobbies, anything. And once you really know what your craft is, it doesn't have to be stand-up, it could be anything. You start seeing these parallels, like we were talking about wrestling. You're like, there are so parallels between all these different things. If you look, or like, who would think there's parallels between stand-up and athletics? But there really is, you know. Or and you kind of just get that by getting away from, you know, the one thing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I just think that's obsession, right? And obsession in anything is bad, and desperation in anything is bad. And that's the thing that I had to get away from in order to start having a better life for myself, just because people can always read it. And as you said, I believe in all of it. It's relationships, right? At the heart of everything we do is relationships. When we go on stage, we're having a one-sided relationship where we present a thing and hopefully their response is either to laugh or just be quiet, you know?
Yeah.
And when we're trying to be on a show, or we're doing an audition, all these things are coming in a relationship. And if you come in desperate, everybody reads that as on a basic human nature level. It's off-putting. It makes you think someone is trying to get something from you.
Absolutely. And so true. Yeah.
If you come in, nothing has ever been better in my life, whether it was dating, business, anything, is if I come in happy already as a positive, as I'm going to add something to your life. You're not coming in doing me a favor. I'm great. You don't want to give me the job? Cool. I still appreciate the opportunity to show what I'm able to do. You don't want to date me? We're not a match. Cool. I know I'm good. It's fine. And that brings more people to you when you're the opposite, when you're like, I got to climb this ladder. I got to do this. People read it so much and it pushes you away.
Yeah. And I think that desperation also can lead to being bitter or being, unhappy, you know. Just, I mean, of course you put so much on one event, if it's talking to someone you're attracted to or whatever, it's definitely not a good, especially for comedy, it's not a good place for it to come from.
No, you want to be confident. You want to feel like, I think that was one of the biggest shifts for me, was like, I used to get on stage and it would feel like I was getting on a roller coaster, where I'd be like, oh my God, we're taking off and hopefully this all ends. And then I, at one point in my head, I just got the shit. I was like, oh, I'm not supposed to be on the roller coaster. I'm the guy who's supposed to be pulling the lever, sending people down this roller coaster. I'm in charge.
Yeah. Wow. That's a great metaphor. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. I'm killing it today.
You are.
Thank you for saying so. What was it like being a model? That seems fun.
It's so funny. The things that I've learned in stand-up would have applied so well in modeling. I was always super skinny. I would go to a pool party and wear a t-shirt. Like I didn't think of myself as a model. And my friends went to college. I grew up with a woman who had some success in the fashion industry, had a lot of success and was like, you should be a model. And I kind of just fell into it. And it was great. You know, I got to live in Europe as a, 19-year-old. And it was fun, but it's all the things that we're saying now, if I had have applied kind of the confidence that I developed over the years to that, I mean, modeling, like everything else, is a racket. Like you're really selling yourself. And obviously there's like superficial aspects to it. And I was really kind of embarrassed just by, I didn't feel like I should have been there to a certain extent. And so I look back and I'm like, but then again, maybe if I had have applied a different attitude and had success in the fashion industry, I wouldn't be a comedian. I wouldn't be talking to you now. The big thing I got from it was I'm from a small town in Canada. Predominantly the people work at the car, like an automotive factory, which did not appeal to me. And people didn't like their jobs. And my dad growing up was in the insurance business. He hated his job. What I got out of the fashion industry was the first time I met adults, photographers and stylists and stuff that were like passionate about what they did. I didn't know anyone could like their job. I would meet a photographer and they're like, I got a camera when I was 5. I love, they love taking photographs. And the big lesson I got, and I'm grateful I got it as a teenager, was, oh, you can find something you're passionate about. So it really left me looking for that. And thankfully I found kind of comedy right after modeling. So, but that was the big thing was, people that love their job. And I guess there were models too, that just, I don't know, felt really cool that it could see the upside. I appreciated traveling, but I felt weird the whole time, kind of.
Yeah, no, I imagine so. And I never, as a fat kid and a character actor boy, so I had never really understood the plight of the traditionally handsome or beautiful person until I started working more with them and seeing just how much people judge them and judging, I guess it would be the right word, on the appearances, how superficial it can be and how, I just remember working on this show with this guy and I was eating something and he was just like, oh, I wish I could eat that. He's like, but for the next 6 scenes, I'm shirtless. And I was
yeah. Rod, it's so funny you say that because, and again, I was not there were male models that were like, dang, this dude looks like he's like carved out of marble. Like, they look like these like Roman gods. And I was not, I just, at the time they liked skinny. I was like skinny with long hair and that was kind of the look. And that I just kind of like fell into it like that. But I remember like I'd eat peanuts. I remember eating a peanut and another guy being like, do you know the fat content? Like, and I had never, it was before that was fat content was in the vernacular of everyone or whatever. And I didn't have to go to the gym. I didn't have to, they just kind of wanted me to look how I happened to look, but mm-hmm. Yeah, you see these guys, you're just like, it's insane to see someone that, handsome or like just put together in person. You're like, it does seem kind of surreal. A lot of muscle.
Yeah. Yeah, nothing made me feel better than when a real, I don't even remember who it was, but they're a really handsome person. And then they just, at one point, they were like, I wish I had your charisma. And I was like, hell yeah, this is great. I like that.
Yeah,
thank
yeah,
you for telling me that. We should find a way to put fuse together and we would be unstoppable. But the thing that, more importantly, the thing that you said that I really enjoyed is just, finding that spark about, like, you can do thing that you love that, in a town that I grew up in, you didn't see that at all either. Everybody worked at a job that they hated. Everybody, was always about the reward that you get when you retire, right? Like, you're just supposed to get a stable job that you can hold on to, that gives you good benefits, and you can retire. And I'm, think if anything, one of the great lessons that the pandemic taught us is that nothing like that is ever guaranteed. So you might as well, it's the same stress. That's one of the biggest gifts of following my dreams has ever taught me, is that the same stress that I had when I worked at a grocery store and was worried about my hours and if I was going to be able to pay my bills, it's the same stress that I had when I was coming up doing mics and shows and trying to figure out if I could book a venue to give me money on one of their off nights. But instead of relying on someone else to give me hours, it was all on me. And I preferred that. And I was like, I'm just, and not, that's not for everybody. And I understand that, but it is for me. Cause I'd rather at the end of the day, blame me if something doesn't go right, than be like, my boss sucks. I can't do this job and I hate it. And just finding out something that you love is a real cheat code to life. Just two quick stories for me was that I remember before, I've wanted to do comedy probably since I was 5 years old, but it took a lot of self-reflection and growth to be like encouraged to get to that point. But I remember one night, maybe a year or two before I started comedy, I went and saw the Parliament Funkadelic at a concert in Portland, Oregon with my first wife. And I just had the time of my life and danced for like 3 hours straight of just never. I remember being like, my feet hurt, but I can't stop dancing. I'm having so much fun. And then the show ended and everybody was letting out. And it just hit me at this point. I was like coming out of this high and I was like, oh man, I'm having so much fun. And I got to go work at the bank tomorrow that I hate. And I hate this thing. And I got to go lie to people about why they got funds fees and all these other things and why they overdrafted. And then I saw them loading up in the bus and I was like, oh, they're going to go do this again tomorrow. And there was just a thing in me where I was like, I gotta find a thing where I feel like that every day and I get to go have fun again every night. And comedy, that was it. Cause I was willing, you know, I had to start at the bottom, of course, and some parts sucked, but I genuinely love doing it every night. And one time I talked to my aunt about it and she was after a show and I was happy and she was like, oh, you look so happy. She's like, you have so much fun at your job. And I was like, I do. She's like, you love it, don't you? And I was like, yeah, I do love it. I actually go, I bet sometimes you don't even think about getting paid. And I go, that's true. I go, actually, sometimes if a job's really good, I forget that I can get paid. And then they give me a check and I'm like, what? I get paid for this? And then she just looks me dead in the eyes and goes, I've never felt like that a day in my life. And I was like, oh, I'm blessed.
Yeah.
This is heaven on earth to find what you want to do and to be successful at it is you know, icing on the cake.
Yeah. No, first off, any story that involves Funkadelic, I love. But because that I love Grateful Dead, but I love Parliament Funkadelic. And yeah, it's so true. They get to do it the next night. And yeah, I mean, who has more fun in life than Boosie Collins? Like, yeah,
no one.
Yes. I remember when I saw Boosie Collins in Toronto when I was a teenager and he came out, he started playing the song. And the chorus was like, I want to touch somebody. And he came out in the crowd and was like putting his arm around everybody and giving everybody hugs and the band's playing. And it was so beautiful. But Yeah, I'm the same with you. Like, I often think, like, the shows I would do for free, I need to be paid to just wake up at 5 and get to the airport and, eat almonds on the flight.
The traveling sucks. The shows are great. Everything else is great. And I even think that's one of the cheat codes again, and like doing other things. Like acting, I genuinely love it. Like, I get such a rush from it. It makes me feel good when I nail a scene or when I push myself into a place I didn't think I could go. But I would never do it for free. You would never see me like, I spent 6 months on this shoot and we didn't make any money, but we're on this student film together. That's not me. I don't love it like that. I love stand up like that. I do stand up free now, but I would never act for free. But what acting has allowed me to do is then be more selective with the gigs that I take and truly enjoy them. And it takes stand up kind of back to where it was for me at the beginning, where it's like, oh, I'm just going out and having fun and practicing. And if I bomb, I don't care if this booking agent does it, or this, manager, this club is like, you didn't, it's fine, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, 100. It's 100%. And I feel the same way about acting. When I, I've taken classes over time, and I've, over the years, and I've, done some acting and stuff. And I'm, again, I love it. I love the fact that you're working on it with other people. That feels really good, because stand up is such an individual thing. But when I really, when it dawned on me that, like, oh, actors do what I do with stand up. Like, yeah, free student films and, all these things for free and all that. And I realized, I'm like, yeah, I had the same realization that you're talking about, where I was just like, I really like it. And I certainly admire people that are skilled at it. And I am excited to get the opportunities to do it, but it's not. Yeah. Like, I would not get up at 6 a.m. to do a student film in the cold. Whereas
no,
I do stand
gross.
Up under
just
any
that sentence made me shiver.
I would, but with stand up, I would do it at any, basically any opportunity type thing.
Yeah, I'm starting to be more selective about it. I'm like, ooh, this wasn't this weed show where everybody was just fully baked out of their minds and doing dabs while I'm trying to tell jokes. Probably not necessary.
Yeah, no, I you're right. Sorry, maybe I'm exaggerating, but I do. There was a point, certainly when I started, because there wasn't a ton of stage time in Vancouver at the time. So I would do any, I'd go up in between bands. I would do pot rooms that were kind of music open mics that I would go, I'd do anything, but it got to the point where I was like, I've learned so much from those terrible gigs, but now if I continue to do them, I don't want to tarnish my love for stand-up. So I didn't want to resent, there's a point where you aren't getting anything out of it.
Yeah. Not only they burn you out, they can teach you bad habits. And I think, sometimes I can see that in I can tell comedians who have been down that road, because they're always like fighting with, they assume the audience is coming in negative.
Yes,
and if they're
absolutely
on my show, sometimes I have to be like, hey, no, they're actually usually happy to be here. So you can assume they want to see you. You don't have to start off angry.
Yeah. No, yeah. There are comics. They do develop like a defensiveness or whatever it's just human nature. They've been like in these like hammer fights of shows for years or whatever. So yeah, there is a point where you do want to protect your love for it.
No, absolutely. I think it's highly important just for your sanity, because everything doesn't need to be a fight. I think there's a martyr syndrome that comes with being a stand-up comedian a lot of times, of proving that like I could make this person laugh and I turned this hardest room. And I used to be like that, and I still pride myself on going on a lot of rooms. I know there's a lot of comedians who are similar to me who don't necessarily want to go to the Comedy Store or things like that, because they're like, oh, that's not the type, they're not in it. I'm like, oh, but it's Comedy Store is one of the greatest rooms you could ever do. It's, you really know what something works or not. But at the same time, I'm just big into like, I'd rather be like, I'm a flower. And then if you put me in the right conditions, I'm going to grow even better. Can I grow in concrete? Sure, but it's going to look weird and be withery. How about you give me some nice fertilizer and soil and light, and we can really see what I can do.
Exactly. Know? Yeah.
Ah, I like talking comedy with you, Phil. You're cool as fuck. We got to hang out next time you're in LA.
I'd love to. Can I ask you about your video game collection?
Sure. Yeah.
May I inquire? One of my favorite video games of all time was the old school wrestling game. Mm-hmm. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
WrestleFest?
WrestleFest, yes.
Yeah.
Do you have a WrestleFest?
It's in this machine. Yeah.
Are you serious?
It's in there. Yeah.
So that's a bunch of different games?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's actually, it's got like 1,000 games. I usually switch probably between 3, being Super Street Fighter 2. Sometimes I play X-Men versus Street Fighter on there. And then, I'm playing WrestleFest on there. That's about it.
I didn't even know the technology had that. You could have 1,000. That's incredible.
Yeah, no, you can. It's out there. It's not that bad either. What's this thing? Think $2,000 for this guy? And then it's got everything in there. And it's
wow.
It made me feel good. Yeah.
I'm sure. It makes me feel good just knowing it exists.
Phil, people need to watch your special. So give them one less hard sell. I know why. I think they should watch it because I watched it and I thought it was hilarious. And they know I'm not a bullshitter. I don't invite people on if I don't like it. And I don't say things that are hilarious if I don't mean it. I laughed how hard. Like, it was just from the chest and the stomach. If you like what I just consider to be classic comedy, which is personal, which is coming from a unique perspective, which is somewhat sweet nature, but still with an edge. You tell some really sharp jokes, real fun stories. I like the one about you talking to your teacher where you were like, oh, if I had known, I would have said talking shit about you is how I'll make money. That's a good spoiler without giving it away, I thought,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
I
think you did it perfect. Thank you.
So I know why I think they should watch it on YouTube, on your YouTube channel. Why do you think they should?
Well, I mean, I think they would enjoy it. I feel like, you know, I'm getting a lot of positive feedback, but I would be extremely grateful if they would go and just type in Phil Hanley, ooh la la. And and if they enjoy it, providing it for free. I just said, if you subscribe, that would make me feel good too. But I think a lot of people, you know, it's very personal material, but I think it's, you know, relatable to a lot of different people. And that's what I hear, which means a lot to me.
No, I agree. And I think that's what being specific does, right? When you're so specific and you're true to yourself, it becomes universal.
Yeah,
so many people chase it the other way around, but it's
so funny. It's so wild. Sorry to interrupt, but yet really, I couldn't agree more.
No, absolutely. And again, I mean, we're not the biggest podcast in the world, but a lot of my people are very loyal and I don't ask you guys for much. But if you're looking for comedy, if you're looking for a little pick me up, if you're looking for something, especially through this holiday season, who isn't? Why don't you go to Phil's YouTube channel? Why don't you watch that special from beginning to end? Afterwards, the least you could do is hit subscribe. That's like the very least you could do. It is free. It don't cost you anything. You don't even really ever got to go back there ever again. But if you hit subscribe, it'll make him better and get his word out there, get his YouTube special out there. And if you love it, if you into it, maybe you're sitting back and you see that Venmo pop up and you are like, you know what? I would have paid to go see him, but he's not coming to see this city anytime soon. So I'm going to go send him a few bucks. That probably be very helpful. Or if you don't want to do that, you can go over to what's your website. Where can people see your calendar?
PhilHanley.com. And my Instagram, where I plug everything, is Phil M. Hanley on Instagram.
Well, you all guys already knew that because you guys are big Hanley heads. So you already at philhanley.com every week just checking for new updates. I knew that about you already. So you could go there, find out when he's going to your town, make sure it sells out so he continues to build up. Again, dog, you could at least do is hit that Venmo or follow those socials, because why not? He used to be a model, so there's got to be something good to look at over there. That's all I'm asking from you guys. If you could do that for me, thank you. Phil, the last thing I'm going to ask you to do for me is the same thing we ask every guest, and that's for a last little pearl of wisdom, a little nugget, something that our Getting Better audience can use. I don't care if it's from when you were a kid, something you learned recently, something you learned from shooting your special, whatever it is, just something to help our Getting Better community to get better.
I would say, and it's reiterating what we discussed earlier, there's two things that I will say. One thing that we discussed earlier, which is something that I constantly need to remind myself of, is just not project that something's going to be negative, because obviously then even worse than the actual moment, you're dreading it beforehand. And something that we kind of touched on before is when I first started travel, like the traveling aspect of stand-up, I hated waking up, you know, in the morning. I hated missing my girlfriend. I hated missing, you know, my family having, and I, at some point I just accepted that this traveling part is part of the full picture of stand-up. I'm so sorry. That's my buzzer. So
that's
sorry.
Fine. Sounded like a landline phone. I was like, wow. Whoa. So it's like,
can
old
I grab
school
that, Ron?
Eastern
I'm so sorry.
Canadian.
I'm so sorry. Can I grab that? I'm so sorry.
Sure.
Sorry, Brian. I can't believe that happened.
That's fun.
Yeah,
the buzzards were wrapping it. Are you giving me the go home button? Are you wrapping me up?
I wasn't expecting anything. I don't know what that is. But I would just say that I did at some point, I accepted that travel was part of stand up and I just kind of accepted it. And before I accepted it, I would get even the whole day I would arrive in these cities and I'd be grumpy and dreading the travel or like resenting it. And I just kind of accepted that it's part of it. And it's total yin and yang, you know, and it's really helped me. I can just sit back in a flight. I've accepted it. Can, you know, enjoy to a certain extent, certainly more than I did before.
Absolutely. I think, again, just like letting go and letting yourself be comfortable in the uncomfortable is one of the greatest lessons that you can have. And it's one of the things that I practice when I go on set, like we're getting ready to go back to work on this show. And it's like, you know, 12, 14 hour days. And I used to be this guy when I come in and they'd be like, okay, what time are we going to be wrapped tonight? What time are we going to be wrapped tonight? And at one point I was just like, I'm going to stop asking that because I've committed to this and I'm into this. And whenever we go home is when we go home. And now I just kind of look at it like a jail sentence. I'm just like, just let me know the day that I'm free. Other than that, I'm going to be out here reading books, doing push-ups and trying to get my GED.
No, it makes the best. It's so true. Just to you, I would be the same way that I would be shooting something. And we're used to going to the club, doing 45 minutes, being in your car, listening to music and you know what I mean? And just accept things and make the best of it. And so often, like you said, it's like you're on set for however long it's as long as you're going to be there. And you might as well have the best time you can while you're there.
Absolutely. And I think a big part of that is sometimes realizing that you're in control of that situation and travel in general. Something that's important to me is being like, oh, okay, I can make this better. Like I travel so much. I can. It's so weird. And I talk to a lot of comedians and some of them are either on it and some of them aren't. But when I meet comedians and they don't have like Sky Lounge access, they don't have these things. And I'm like, you fly a lot, right? You have a lot of miles, right? So you could take those miles and then use them to get Sky Lounge access. So then when you go to the airport, you're not buying your food. You're not punched up next to a bunch of other people, even though now the Sky Lounge is still very packed. But it's just a better experience in learning to treat myself better. I think a lot of comedians and just people in general were used to like, well, I don't deserve any better than this. I'm going to soldier through this. And just being like, well, I'm going, like you said, if I'm going on set, I'm going to bring a candle. I'm going to bring a portable speaker. I'm going to make it as, and I do this for backstage. In any place I am, I try to make it as close to home as possible.
Yeah. It makes all the difference. And no matter if it's travel or whatever you're saying, there is something that people dread. And it is worth that investment of being conscious of how you can improve it a little bit. And those little improvements add up 100%.
Truly. Phil, you're fun to talk to. You're a great comedian. You're a good guy. You got a dad face with the beard and stuff. How could people hate you? You're the best, man. It's been a pleasure to get to know you a little bit better.
Ron, yeah, it was so great to talk to you. I'm grateful that to be on your podcast. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's a true pleasure. I wish you nothing but success. I can't wait to see you again, hopefully in person. Yeah. We can go out, get something to eat together. I'd love it.
Right on, man. Thank you so much, Ron. And I can't wait to the next time I'm in LA or you in New York. I'd love to meet up.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming. Thank you guys for listening. Bye.